Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
And Mr. Justin Robert Young.
What's up, fam?
Gentlemen, been a slow news week. And yep. And even despite that, NASA had an announcement that in any other week would have gotten a lot of attention, but was, you know, literally like number 12 in the headlines. We'll skip a lot, 1 through 11. And their Perseverance rover, which has been rolling around the surface of Mars, you know, a robot operating on Mars. Remember, more robots on Mars than humans right now. We need to fix that.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk about take our jobs. Come on, man.
I know.
That's
basically. You know, it goes up, it drills into rocks, it does some chemical analysis of substances there, which is kind of cool because it's not just, we're not just doing looky look, we're able to get much more closer looks, drill into it, and get more examples of stuff. And what they did is there's a region that they've been inspecting, and this came out in a research paper in Nature. This was a sample they found before, which was basically they looked up close, had tiny spots, and has chemical patterns. And wherever we see this on Earth, it's where microbes interact with materials. And if you saw these little, you know, features on Earth materials, you'd be like, oh, yeah, we know this. It's created by a biological process, et cetera. So NASA wrote a paper, and it was a very, hey, this is what we observed. These are all the tests we've run on it. As far as we know, whenever we see this, it's caused by life. Doesn't mean it couldn't be some natural forming way it could have happened. We just don't know what it is. And now here's a paper, you know, go find some other means by which this could have been created. So this was in an area that NASA selected for the mission because it had held water for a considerably long period of time. It looked like a really strong candidate. If you're going to go look for life, go look for a place where, which was natural formation. We said water probably was there for many millions of years, perhaps, and go look for samples there. And they found something that you kind of hope to find. Next big step, will, of course, if we do a sample return, will we actually return samples to Earth to go look at it more closely? But possible biosignature.
Okay, so right now I just searched Google News for life on Mars, and I got underrated drama talk. I mean, what are they hiding? I'm just going to type Mars. There we go. Yeah, man, this would be, oh, I don't know, the biggest thing ever, or maybe, I never know how to feel in these moments because, like, on the one hand, yes, biggest thing ever, of course, but also, at the end of the day, got to get to work, Jack. I got to make money.
Jack. Yeah.
By which, what I mean is,
All politics are local is the, you know, the one of the greatest news values that you can learn as a journalist is proximity. And so, like, yes, this is a very, very big deal in the world of science, quite possibly, right? But, you know, what does it mean?
Well,
yeah, I think it's adorable that you went and did a Google News search instead of using ChatGPT and used, you know, a more advanced tool to get the...
So is that officially where we're at in terms of like we trust it for up to the minute stuff? I mean, I Grok is already cemented in my mind as at least I'll know what everyone's talking about in the moment, whether or not it's everyone is accurate or not.
This is you, Brian. This is you, Brian.
Yeah, I am. I'm holding a mouse. Is that a mouse?
Friendship is my pick this week.
Oh,
Andrew has held up the caveman's tool, plays a role in the movie. Oh, okay. Friendship.
Like, that was really random.
Yeah.
I use it all the time. Because ChatGPT now, when you do even auto mode, if you say, hey, go check this, the first thing it does, it searches the web to get the most latest details on that.
That's good. But in general, usually I find Google News pretty good for knowing that stuff, but I think that it I fell for the autocomplete. But there was so specifically, this is something that in general, if we saw it anywhere else, we'd say, yep, that's a biological effect. And now they have to crack the interesting puzzle of like, okay, how, what would a possible other reason that wouldn't be biological, be similar to like methane on Titan or finding oxygen on an extra solar planet.
Yeah. I mean, the challenge is that anytime we look at another planet, there is going to be different chemical processes than on Earth, because you're going to have different chemical makeups. You're going to have different geological structures because, you know, what does, you know, this much quartz and this much copper next to each other happen after 5 million years at 3G? You know, there's this temperature. So that's part of it, is that, you know, every planet has been this oven of experiments that have been baking for a long time. And ours apparently created life. You know, that's the cool thing. Ours created extremely complex self-replicating molecules that became who we are. And when we look at other planets, we have to ask ourselves, okay, this looks like something that a self-replicating molecule would create, but maybe there could be some other thing. We had that in the 90s with the NASA rock. Remember, they found, you know, the rock in Antarctica that came from Mars, and they found like the little tiny structures that looked maybe like worms, but they were smaller than any life we'd seen on Earth.
Yeah. And ultimately, what was it decided was the cause of those? Because they really did look like electron microscope, you know, microscopic doodads.
Inconclusive, I think. I think there were some papers that came out and said, hey, we think this could have been, here are some suggestions of like similar things we've seen on Earth that weren't created by biology. So I think it was like, not strong enough, you know, to do that.
So undetermined.
There's undetermined stuff going back to the original Viking mission, because the one of the researchers on that had put together a chemical lab on there to sniff out certain life signs and science, you know, for they're looking for. And he claims like, yeah, we had strong indications of biosignatures on that, but the rest of NASA said, no, it's too inconclusive, and we didn't pursue it any further.
How crazy that it's very likely in our lifetime that how far off do you think we are from, let's say, politics aside, Tesla humanoid robots walking around on Mars? Like, if you were to place a hard bet of when that happens,
Can I just have humanoid robots and maybe?
Yeah, they're going to be brand agnostic.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I'm going to assume there's natural synergy from the same company.
Brand agnostic. Let's say brand agnostic.
I'm just saying, if you're asking me the time frames for who's going to get the humanoid first, I don't know. But as far as having robots on Mars, being able to do this, soon. But here's the thing is, if you talk to the head of, and I think I've ever talked to, like, you know, one of the other early robotic space missions to Mars, who said, yeah, like, this is great. I would rather have a geologist there because I can get more work done in an hour than I can get in a month with a robot. It's just, you know, we'll see, you know, we'll see. I think our ability to get to Mars is going to develop pretty rapidly. We see that, you know, it's been exciting to see. And if you watch, we had the last Starship launch, you know, where Starship actually was able to go up, reach orbital velocity, go land, and actually hit the target near a point in the sea close to the buoy. We actually caught it on camera. We were able to see it. It was amazing. So I think there, the robotics thing, like one of the big things in robotics is the idea of a test is, could it, if you gave it an IKEA box, could it put together everything inside of there? Right.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
And that's a thing where, and I believe we're going to make fast progress. I mean, I'm very bullish on the fast progress in robotics, but the challenge is this, and I see challenge. I don't mean, oh, it's a blocker. It means the next thing we have to do. And I would say language models, I can tell you the clear path to AGI seems kind of like it's there. There may be blockers, but it's just systems that are very highly capable. We seem pretty well there because we know how to create data and do that. You know, when I pick up, you know, a little sponge, like the sponge ball here, okay? I have a ton of data, both through evolution, you know, evolving over billions of years, that goes in and forms my nerves, endings, and everything else on how to pick it up, the right amount of weight, and what to do with this. And we see in machine learning, these things can pick up a lot of things pretty quickly, but all of a sudden, I can feel the texture of this and make sense of the texture of a coin. And we need new ways to do this, to figure out that kind of data. We don't have the, you know, language models learn because we have a world filled with language. We have the internet, we have Reddit, we can create this conversations and stuff. The world of physical data we still need, and we're building that, and we will. And it just the time frame, I don't really have a good grasp of when I'd rather send a humanoid robot versus a human. We'd send both. I mean, we'll send humanoid robots
no,
first.
No, I think the core of the question is just the time wise. If you were going to gauge when the first foot hits Mars,
placing a bet,
what would you say timeline from now?
Yeah, I'd say that Tony is like the next step we look for is a sample return. The next step is let's load a bunch of rocks into a thing and ship it back to Earth where we have all the laboratories, all the stuff to be able to do that. So a time frame we're putting humanoid robots on Mars, Optimus, whatever, shoving things into a box and shipping them back to Earth. You know, we could do that, you know, in the next 5 years. Will we? I don't know. We could do that next 5 years, you know?
Yeah. Oh, well, and this is me asking if you're placing a bet. Yeah, because I agree. It really is a question of political will, but I'm asking you if you're going to
Brian's opening a casino.
Exactly.
Called, and it only, it's a sports book that only takes Brian bets.
That's right.
So it's mostly things about whether or not he's reading the same book as me and how many times he'll watch Friendship either in theaters and in VOD. That over under is currently at 5.5.
Yep.
But the new to the board. Brian, do you want to set the line, a tantalizing line for Brian's sports book?
Yeah, I would say, I'm going to set the line at 8.5 years.
Do you go over or under?
Yeah.
Give me the specifics. Give me the polymarket parameters here.
A humanoid robot.
Which, by the way, is terrible for AI betting because they use a really bad metric to evaluate, you know, best models.
That's funny. A humanoid robot walking around on Mars. The line is set at 8.5 years.
I say there's a launch within 5 years.
So it sounds like you're edging under.
I think that the hard part with Mars is because of Mars orbit is that you miss the window and then now you got to wait, you know, another X. So if you ask me...
So then the next window is what, in 2 years, 3 years?
Let's see here.
Because really what you're betting is that humanoid robotics are at a point where we would feel comfortable putting that, having a mission to be on the ship as the tide is high.
Flying Car 100 wants to know, how long does a robot need to last for it to count? One step. One small step is all it has to make, and it can immediately fall over. And the bet will be as long as you get the shot of it, because you know there's going to be an epic selfie of a robot standing on Mars.
We already have, you know, a robot looking thing flying a car in space. The Roadster, you know, Elon.
Oh, yeah, actually. That's right. Another David Bowie song played.
I think that, you know, given the development of Starship, right? Starship is the next big step for them is testing they've landed the booster, which was amazing, you know, in the cradle. The upper stage will be a chest, but they did a soft landing to the upper stage. Now they're working on the heat shield. The problem they had the heat shield, they say now they need to be, you know, provide like, you know, sealing the tiles. They're trying to solve the tile problem. The big problem with Mars is this, and the thing that when he first announced, Elon Musk first announced the SpaceX program, what they're doing with Starship, and a lot of people didn't get, it frustrated me because I think it was really brilliant, was there are two ways to get to Mars. More than two ways, but we'll just cycle or stuff like this. Two simple ways are this. One is I take a rocket, I aim it at Mars, put a ton of fuel at it, launch really fast, then halfway to Mars, I turn the rocket around and I fire my engines and I slow down. Because the problem is when you go to Mars, you have a tremendous amount of velocity, right? You have to slow down, and whatever way space, the way physics works, whatever energy it took you to accelerate, you need the same amount of energy to deaccelerate. And so that was one approach, is you send the rocket towards Mars, flip the rocket around, fire your engines again and slow it down, which means you're spending a considerable amount of time trying to slow in your deceleration towards Mars, when Elon first announced Starship, I remember watching, you know, one of the commenters on the writers for like Jalopnik was like, it's a terrible plan. You know, why is it aerodynamic? It doesn't need to be. And da da da. It's like, because that's not what he's doing. What they're doing in Starship is you fire all your engines, you go through all your fuel, you burn really, really fast, you head towards Mars, then you slow yourself down in the atmosphere. You don't go into orbit. You don't do any of that because that takes fuel. You just go right into the atmosphere, slam the atmosphere, and burn off all that kinetic energy as heat on your heat shields, right? Which means you need much denser heat shields. And so that's the solution they have to solve for now, is because instead of trying to carry all this extra fuel to slow down, you can get there faster if you just go full bore and then slow down, you know, in a few minutes in the atmosphere. But of course, you're taking, you think about all the energy you have when you did your, your launch towards Mars, and you're going to be burning off the same amount of energy off the surface of your heat shields as you go entry. So they need to solve for that. I think that they can solve for this. I think that they'll feel comfortable enough to just do robotic missions, which they'll have to do to begin with. And I think that, you know, given the next window, there's a launch window December 28 to January 29 is the next. There's next one is November to December 2026. So we got a window next year. I don't think they're going to make it. JAXA, which is Japan's space agency, they're going to do the MMX launch there. And then apparently December 2028, January 2029, that's another two-month window. They're going to do the Rosalind Franklin. They're going to send a rover there in that slot. So that's for the minimum energy opportunities. So I would put it slot, not this one, maybe the next one. I think they're going to shoot for that. I think that's going to be a goal, is they're going to try to launch by then.
So, and you do think that it'll be a humanoid robot that you'll put in there?
Yeah, he'll put an Optimus on there. 100%. I mean, 99.999%. Optimus will be at a good enough point that you can put it in there. It'll be able to walk outside there, pick up some rocks and stuff like that. Whether or not that is the best thing to use for that is another question. Do you really just want to use, you know, another a flat vehicle? It's an all-terrain vehicle that can go around and throw a bunch of rocks in there. Maybe that. But I think for testing purposes, I think they're going to do Optimus. And I'm optimistic that we're going to see a lot of development in the next 3 years. I think humanoid robotics in the next 3 years is going to be pretty significant by the time they're ready to put a payload on there. And the advantage of being Elon Musk and SpaceX is he can decide the night before, put this in there.
Yeah. And likely will.
Well, and
likely will.
I assume what you also have the benefit of, you could throw a humanoid robot in there and then you got a 2 year development cycle to update the firmware along the way. Now you wouldn't be able to do a lot of testing, but you could essentially take advantage of the time lag and fix it in post, sort of.
Yeah. I think they can do some really good research there. I think that program will be in full development there. Again, with Mars, we're limited by that. It's one of the reasons why people talk about, like, oh, should we go to Mars or the moon? And I'm like, well, both. And one of the reasons is that Mars has that limited opportunity. You have to, you can only send Mars missions within a certain time span. If you miss that, then you got to wait a couple of years.
The moon is, don't sleep on how complicated the moon is, because you got to time it just right, because otherwise it might not be full and you'll just kind of go right through that gap in the crescent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're going to miss it just a bit outside.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he's going to be singing about moon? McDonald's and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I think that I hope we figure out what we're going to do with NASA. I'd like that to be maybe prioritized more, but I'm excited about moon exploration, because our understanding of the moon is based upon, you know, what we see when we look at it, okay. And then, you know, our Apollo missions, which, you know, last time astronauts were on the moon was before we were born, and there is a lot more to the moon than what we saw. There are massive subterranean chambers. There's caves that go on for miles. There's old volcanic events. Like literally, you know, it's been suggested there could be caverns on the side in Mars large enough to hold Philadelphia.
That's nuts. Yeah, I mean, I think
the moon. I mean the moon. The moon.
Yeah. There's no doubt in my mind that we are going to live to see you know, semi-permanent to permanent settlements on the moon. I mean, certainly in my lifetime. I mean, like, maybe in my immediate, like, that might be something that is like, yeah, because my brain is, you know, politically fried, but it's like I could see it being an issue, a political issue, is what's happening, or a big news story that emanates from a moon base.
You know, that's funny. I think that's worth exploring, because the moment self-driving cars became very real to me was when, of all things, it was like a Cato Institute podcast. And there was somebody from inside Congress saying, yeah, we're having to hash that out right now. And it's like, oh, they're already arguing about the legalities of it, which means it's far enough along that nobody wants to get caught flat footed when it gets there. So
I mean, I know culturally, you know, I don't even really see videos, even from people that are incentivized to talk about how crappy self-driving cars are, or if, you know, self-driving cars are dangerous. Every once in a while, you'll see a video of like, oh, my Waymo stopped before I wanted it to, or whatever. And it's like, all right, like that's, I don't doubt that those things happen. I don't think that people are making them up, but also I'm sure it pales in comparison to Uber complaints of people, or just, you know, bad drivers that do bad driver things. So it's like, but it's a yawn. It doesn't really even get social traction anymore, or virality, because the concept of a malfunctioning Waymo is just the same as any other automotive thing. And I would assume that they happen at less of a proportion than the other things that we also don't care about.
There's, this I call like the Waymo curve, which lasts like 8 minutes. You know, you tell your friends, hey, I'm gonna order a Waymo, like, oh, I don't know this Waymo thing. I see them driving around, pulls up, doors open, like, oh, that's cool. You get like, oh, that music's kind of nice. This is neat. Oh, it's driving by itself. Oh, it's really smooth. Okay.
Yep.
Oh, hey, you got to go to the Fisherman's Wharf. Then yeah, you're like, and now then the next time what happens is you're out of the Waymo and you're like, where do you want to go? Well, let's use a Waymo now. It's like it is incredible adoption.
Every morning at 4:45 when I'm driving to the gym out into hill country, it's just me, Waymos, and random homeless people. That's who's up at 4:45 in the morning. What a crazy future we live in.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we get used to these things very quickly. So back to the whole space thing, I'm confident that we're going to see it. I think Blue Origin is going to keep making progress too, and we'll see that. We've got a couple missions planned for lunar missions. I'm sorry, folks, Titan's not going to happen for a long time. I know Titan sounds great. You get to swim, you get to do this, the radiation production, all that. It's really effing far away.
Yeah.
Really, really far.
Well, so yeah, how long of a trip is it? If it's a couple of years to Mars, do we have probes on the way? Here, let me consult an oracle.
It's a 6 month trip to Mars. It's like a 6 month trip to Mars.
Okay. Let's see. Are there any probes on the way to Titan? Also, when are we going to drill down and find out if there's squids on Europa?
Yeah. Yeah, and here's the thing about Titan, too, I'll say this, because I see these videos like, why we should do Titan instead? And like, well, you're on Mars, you're going to have all this radiation. Titan's going to have, it's like, yeah, in Titan, you're going to spend 7 years in a spacecraft getting exposed to radiation, and you're there forever. You're not going to Mars. You're going to be like, yeah, I spent a year on Mars. You know, I spent 26 months on Mars. Yeah, it's cool, but I was really missing, you know, Earth. And now I'm back. You go to Titan, like, no, I'm sorry. It was nice to know
that's
you, Brian.
That's it. Have fun, Titan. Until we develop radically different transportation methods, it's pretty much a wrap. You are a settler.
Yeah, it was funny because I saw, like, I watched a video. I was like, this is why Mars, Titan's much better than Mars. They never talk about the travel time to Titan.
Yeah.
And the radiation exposure, which is fine. Mm-hmm. We'll solve for that.
Yeah. You get superpowers.
So the Oracle says, let's see. We got Dragonfly on the way to Titan, supposed to, it doesn't launch until 2028. Man, you took the under on humanoids on Mars. I don't know. Titan arrival 2034.
I said launch. I said launch, not on.
Well, that was
for Mars.
That was for Mars.
Yeah,
Titan.
I know.
Titan. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just surprised that the next Titan launch is, you know, 3 years from now.
I mean, it doesn't seem to be and a doesn't arrive pressing until priority for the American government right now. Titan.
Yeah, and remember, Saturn's orbital period, I don't know, what is Saturn's orbital period?
I mean, I would say in general, Mars, so everything comes along with like, all right, well, how much do we care about either in private or public space exploration in general? Right now, we're pretty high on that. Like, we've got good momentum. People are interested. There's a lot of money going into it. That's good. But then at that point, it's like, all right, well, how do you order your priorities? At which point I would say Mars is number one, the moon is second, and then there's a gigantic gap before anything else in terms of excitement and resources.
Yeah, so Saturn's orbital period is 29 years. So you're just basically upon where Earth is in its orbit. So like we're because Mars is like a two-year orbit Earth, there's that period where it's the closest junction's going to be. Saturn's, whatever. Like when we did the Voyager probes, which we hit multiple planets, that was because we had this rare lineup where we knew that, like, oh, we hit here, we can hit here. It was like magic.
Yeah. Man, I'll tell you what, if nothing else, I'm glad that I happen to be alive during the run of Voyager. That truly, I suspect.
Great show.
I suspect that there's a genuine tearjerker documentary on the horizon to just tell the story of just, and I know you want to make a Star Trek joke, but I
liked other shows on the UPN too.
For example, hanging with Mr. Cooper,
Homeboys in Outer Space.
I think that's a movie.
Homeboys in Outer Space.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, no. Is UPN
on UPN.
Oh,
thank you.
No, you're thinking of Star Trek Voyager.
I think both were on the UPN because I'm not going to tell you who, but one of the three of these panelists was a big UPN fan back in the day.
I think a question we have to ask too is that if I've said this before, what will happen is, let's say we do a sample return, whatever, we get the rock and we're like, yeah, bacteria created it. There will still be a debate now. The question that will become the hot topic is like, yeah, but did life develop there, or was it from Earth or from there or whatever? Can life really develop simultaneously on two planets? Because we know now there are all these different methods for cross-contamination. And literally, if you look at the history of the Earth going around the solar system, going around the galaxy, that you could find life on some other planet, 100 light years away. And you might be like, well, it could have been seeded from here or could have been cross-seeded. We don't know. Can it develop independently? But the answer to the question that would be answered, which is still is equally important, is can life survive on these other and adapt onto these other planets?
So this is one we've talked about this before, but for anyone who missed it, Kim Stanley Robinson wrote the fantastic trilogy, Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, and has since kind of altered his take and said, yep, we cannot and will not ever because of, prions or poisonous ground or something?
Perchlorates.
Perchlorates, that's what it was. It was a P.
Yeah.
P word.
Yeah, that was when The Martian came out, that was one of my criticisms of the science. I'm like, why is anybody taking this seriously? And then I go to NASA, meet a scientist. The book inspired me. It's why I'm here. I'm like, everybody should take this book seriously. I'm like, no, you got perchlorates in the soil. Why would you be doing this? All that. But long story short, I guess that's the blocker because humans have never figured out chemistry or how to adapt things or do things like called hydroponics. Wah, wah, end of story. Sorry, guys, Mars is over. Like we literally built boats to cross oceans, to colonize islands with nothing more than like wood and leather. You know, we literally expanded into the Arctic. You know, we literally have tens of thousands of people in the air right now flying magically suspended in the air as a part of transportation. And when I hear people like, yeah, but perchlorates, that's just the blocker. I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you really kidding me? I just think like our ancestors died leaving Africa to go through the Mediterranean into harsh environments, literally go, hey, it's cold. We can't survive. It's cold. We don't have skins like animals. And somebody's like, what if, big brain idea here, guys, see that animal skin? What if we had animal skin like that? Oh, it can't. It'll take us millions of years to adapt. I've got a knife. I have a solution. You know, we were building spacesuits and craft of our own kind. We were figuring out how to adapt the food. So, like, that's just sad.
We stopped dreaming.
Disgusting.
Well, it's that. Yeah, no, we've reached the height of clever. We will never get more clever than we are now. As I sit here with an AI next to me running locally that talks to me, speaks to me, whatever, and is smarter than anybody would have conceived of just a few years ago. But like that would have been considered a greater impossibility than solving the chemistry problem.
Hey guys, I had some real life text come in and I have to run and pick up a daughter that's stranded. I can leave the stream going and then come back and we could just risk it. Is that cool by you guys?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay. Let's do it.
We're just going
to leave eventually. And
that'll be fine. I'll edit it later. Just let me know. I'm going to, this will be an interesting experiment.
Okay. See you later.
All right. Fingers crossed. I'll tell you what, I'll be listening from the other hinterlands. Bye guys.
Bye.
This is how the apocalypse happens, Justin. I know. It's just, you know, literally.
I just hope that when we sign off, the window automatically closes and he left something really embarrassing and personal on the web browser that then becomes the live stream.
I would say, oh, I agree, but the chances of that being true are too high. I won't agree with that.
Like, yeah, you're right. You want to know? I strike that from the record.
Yeah.
We admirably spent 30 minutes not talking about AI, so we can probably finally let our guard down and talk about what we often like to talk about on this show, and that is the latest in artificial intelligence. I don't know if we've talked on this show about how much you've been getting into the local, the open source, open AI model, but do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and I'm into all of the above. I've always been in all of the above because I think that an analogy I'll give you is there's this delightful documentary from like BBC from like 1966. And it's like the man who lives with a computer, right? And it's typical BBC documentary fashion, extremely staged, but still charming. This guy wakes up and he's got a computer next to him. It's a teletype, right? And that day, a teletype was connected to an electronic brain 8 miles away. Okay. Yeah. And it goes, he's like, what are the stock prices? They types in, click, click, click. And then it goes, and he gets the close. It gets the stock prices. But it was a really cool portent of things to come because one is, you know, at that point to talk to one, he's talking to a remote server that has access to stock market data. He also says, what is my diary? And it goes, diary today. And it says something like, you know, meeting with Moon Corp. I'm like, okay, you just made this up, you know, to show that he's getting his electronic diary there. But the guy wakes up, 1966, gets there, gets the stock, gets the latest stock news. He gets his schedule, his calendar. He knows what it's going to be doing that day. I'm sure if he knew another nerd that had one of these computers, they would have been sending messages. They show him teaching his kid how to use it. And you can often see the shape of things by stepping back and looking at that. I've mentioned this before. One of the things that a book we give to people at OpenAI when they join up was Arthur C. Clarke's Portrait of the Future, which is his book sort of examining the future. And I've got several of his other books on futurism. If you step back and take a look at the future, you kind of see certain patterns. One is the idea that, you know, it's neat to have your own thing, but it's also neat to connect to things. You know, you have your own little thing, then you want to connect to something. And sometimes it happens in one order and sometimes it happens in another. You know, we had VCRs in homes and people were like, it'd be cool to have my own camera and make my own videos, you know?
Yeah.
And then now everybody has a phone that makes videos and we do this stuff. So it kind of goes in different directions. I love, right now I've got the GPT OSS 20 billion parameter model, which a modern computer, you can run it. You know, I run out of my Mac, takes 11 gigs of space, takes up that much memory. And that's incredible, because having worked at OpenAI when we did the release of GPT-4, and if you said to me, hey, you know, 2 years, you know, somebody's going to be able to run something this capable locally, I'd be like, no, it's
locally.
And part of what made this possible, by the way, too, which is, this is the crazy thing, okay? It was literally like 1 year ago today or so that OpenAI announced the O1 model, the idea that they had this new model that used reasoning. And that was a big leap. And just to unpack what that meant was, we realized that it's one thing to have an AI model, which has got all these layers and algorithms that do that solve the problem for you. And I say, hey, give me an answer to this. And it goes through there and gives the answer. And there was the idea that, what if I let it think longer? What does that mean? Well, one of the ways you can have a model think longer is you say, hey, figure out the first step. Now I'm going to take that answer, I'm going to put that back in here and say, hey, this is the first step. Now go through and handle the second step and third step. And Brian loves talking about, like, we have the different kinds of thinking, you know, that's what learning, thinking fast, thinking slow. There's my fast reaction. You think that's what an LLM does. Thinking slow is letting an LLM take more time and to break down each part of the problem, okay? So now, you know, when you go into GPT-5 or ChatGPT and you say, I want high or medium, whatever, you're telling it how much time to spend thinking. So that's what made this possible, was it's a small model. It's way smaller than what a GPT-4 is. But they said, oh, we can make a really efficient small model, but let it think that longer reason. On a thing.
Yeah.
And that was amazing. And that was just finally a year ago, and every modern model does that.
Yeah, O1, right? O1 was only a year and a day ago. O1 was the first one,
Yeah, O1 was a year ago, like a year ago this week. So I like the idea. Yeah, I play with this because I think the future is going to be, I know a lot of people are like, one day I'll just have it all locally. I'm like, you might, but then you're not going to have the advantage of the really super capable models right now. Like right now when I code, I use the OpenAI thing called Codex. I can go in and I can code in the command line. I can go code in a code tool like Cursor or whatever. There's also, when you want to, you can actually go into ChatGPT and say, I want you to solve it, and solve it in the cloud. And there's going to be problems where you're going to say, this is a 3-hour problem, or this is a really complicated problem. My local computer can't do this.
Yeah.
I want you to do this. Or my local computer is solving a problem and it realizes it needs more help. It will just send it off to the cloud.
Yeah.
But I think about the local model is, I could run this thing. I left this thing running nonstop. I've had this thing running on my computer nonstop. I've had it installed, do everything else. What does that mean? You know, Justin, you talk about the news, you talk about that. It's like, yeah, we could have the thing. I was thinking, like, man, we create a thing called it like monitoring the situation and literally be a dashboard, tell the topics you're interested in. And it could continuously be in doing that. If it's got nothing else, it could just be generating deep research reports for you. And
I've been thinking about this. We were talking about this the last time we were hanging out, of just like the capabilities that local model is now. What is remarkable about it is that it's so cheap relative to what you would do on an API that you can just create endlessly, essentially. Like you have the ability to continue to go and go and go and go. And it's like, all right, like where what unlocks from there? You know, especially when now it's local to your device, you can have it access things that, you know, would be valuable to it. You know, to your point of like, oh, well, eventually everything will run locally. I would say to that person,
That's not my point. Yeah. The person, but hypothetical,
the person,
yeah.
I would say to that person, yes. And you'll run it in the cloud and you'll run it in places and devices that we're probably not even thinking right now. It's like, all right, we had the personal computer. Well, then why do I need a computer in my pocket? Why do I need a computer on my wrist? Because I do, because I want it, because I've thought of ways that it will benefit my life, that there are times that I will literally be in front of a computer. I will have another computer next to me. I'll be distracted by this computer in my hand, and then an alert will come in on my wrist. That's how many computers I need and I want and I get use out of. And I think that everywhere where there's a computer, for sure, we're going to have some kind of LLM running on it. And the better we distill these models, the more we are able to you know, put hard drives on devices that might otherwise not need hard drives. But to put an LLM in a device is going to be advantageous. We're going to figure out ways that just reasoning capabilities are going to be everywhere on from a physical capacity. And that's what really excites me, because 12 gigs, I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen, you know, how small hard drive space can be, but like 12 gigs can go anywhere. You can put 12 gigs on absolutely anything.
I think you're going to see people thinking about operating systems differently. If you're Microsoft and Microsoft's got their own Phi model, which are very tiny models, probably thinking about like, oh, what if I make that part of the download? And then I can have it running all kinds of stuff in the background and handling stuff. You know, Apple's been working on that in their own way. We're seeing that idea of like across
the people that need to be, like, if there's not people working on that right now, everybody needs to be ejected out of that spaceship that they're sitting in. Like they need a local model, a great local model on their devices.
Yeah, they've done some cool stuff on figuring out how to get local models to work. And I've there was a company that came out with like a speech thing that they're like, oh, because it sucks on Apple. I'm like, I don't want to be betting, you know, a $30 million valuation that Apple's not going to figure out how to take a speech to text model like Parakeet and slim it down enough to run great locally, because I already can run local. I mean, they aren't going to have somebody like there's a lot of weird bets right now. I'm like, maybe there's a business there, but if you're betting that they won't figure out this easy thing, they're going to figure out that easy thing. You're not going to have a long-term marketplace there, and other things they're just never going to figure out. But yeah, I think it's everywhere. It's like, it's the idea that with the teletype example was the software was all run in the cloud, and what it was the future. The software was running everywhere. You know, we run software on our phones. Our phones connect to servers that run software in the cloud. We do this. And the scale, you know, we Justin and I do another little podcast. Justin writes and produces for called the OpenAI podcast. And that's with a little tech company called OpenAI. We like to help them out, you know, give them some attention, you know, do what we can. And they got a founder there. He's got a lot of ideas. And we talked to him 2 months ago. And the thing that, you know, I was asking him about Stargate, and that's OpenAI's plan to build like, you know, this humongous series of data training, you know, of data centers for both training models and doing inference and stuff. And I'm like, why all this? Why all this compute? And Sam's response was, if people realized all the things you could do with it, you would want more. And
yes,
I agree, you know, and we, people go, oh, I don't really know. And then you get the Ghibli images from OpenAI or Nano Banana, you know, from Google, which is Google's Nano Banana, great model. Super fun, super fast. My wife and I have been using this for interior decorating because we have a decorator who's a wonderful person, but she would send us these things from her 3D guy, and they're often just out of proportion, whatever, grossly over expensive what they're doing. And I'm like, let's just go into Nano Banana and ask it to do it. We do it, and it's doing this great. Roshni, my wife, has probably spent like $60 on credits on Replicate right now doing this. She's like, I regret none of it. I'm like, yeah, I agree. Like, this is
I was I wondering what stuff. She was doing on Replicate. I walked by her laptop and I'm like, oh, I wonder what she's cooking on Replicate. Yeah. That does make sense.
Yeah, Replicate, by the way, shout out. If you want to play with the stuff and you do not need to be technical, you can become technical. Replicate.com, they work with all the major AI companies and smaller companies. They have open source models. They have all this, the image models. They have their language models. They have a really cool environment. You can go there, play with stuff, just try things out, image models. They have some tutorials there. I'm a big fan of them, of what they've been doing.
They're great. And let me just say, if you are not playing around, if you're not thinking solution first, pie in the sky solution first, and then trying to figure out how to solve for that with these AI tools, win, lose, or draw, like, man, I don't know what to tell you, dog. If you're listening to a show like this that's about the future and about, you know, the far future, the near future, play around with this stuff, man. Oh my God. It's all there for you. And I'm here to tell you, the technology saved us dumbs that didn't know how to code, because it has never been a better time to figure out the architecture by way of a fun and exciting challenge to solve your own problem. Like, and literally all you have to do, your buy-in, is just keep asking questions to a machine that will give you answers, and then you have to be like, all right, well, that answer didn't work, and now can I ask a better question? Can I now understand this thing a little bit better? Can I now ask a bunch of dumb questions so now you get a little bit smarter? Ask it to explain things for you. It's been an incredibly enriching, literally, as we were starting here today, one of my pet projects has been to dump all of my wearable data into, initially I was just like, look, whatever, I just need all the stuff. I'm on a smart scale. I have a smart watch. I go to a gym that I wear a heart monitor the entire time I'm working out. I have a plethora of data that I am doing absolutely nothing with. They sit in siloed apps that create pretty graphs for me that I have no idea what to do with. So I'm like, I just need all that in a place so I can put ChatGPT on top of it and I can ask it questions about my quantifiable self. And man, it's been on and off. Like, I've literally just been doing it before I go to sleep. It's not like I've locked in for a period of time. And I just got it working right before we started. And my God, I am pumped. I am like adrenaline, like super pumped that it's like I saw a bunch of lines propagate on a Google sheet because I hit a button on my phone. And I'm like, let's go. It's so enriching and exciting, and it is all there. It's all happening at the zoo, friends.
I've been saying for years, more people should learn to code, not fewer. There's more to get out of learning to code. Not that you have to go super deep into all this, but to understand what a function does, what these things do, to understand the basics of code. There's a certain, you know, you can learn enough in a week to understand enough to build things and do things. Doesn't mean you learn enough in a week to be a top engineer at a company. That takes years, but you actually might be better than a lot of engineers who are anti-AI right now. But you can learn enough, the expression learn to be dangerous, but you can learn enough to build things that are interesting.
Yeah.
And I feel very, very happy to see, I don't want to say vindicated, but very happy to see that my friends are all coders now.
Yeah.
You know, my friends are all people and to different degrees. They're building things out of code. Their interaction with computers isn't through the apps that they bought from the app store. The interaction now through computers is they go in and make things to do functions and processes and things like this. And, you know, I talked to our buddy Brett Rounseville, who was showing his daughters about vibe coding and stuff and doing a math app, whatever. And the next day they were asking him, wait, could we do this too?
Yeah.
And he's like, yes. And they're excited about that idea. And I think that people are kind of coming around. Like, I don't know where entry-level coding jobs are going to be in the short term. If you're not really an AI native, you don't know what this is. I do know that if you are a person in a normal job who understands AI, like how to use ChatGPT and a bit about code or some of the tools we mentioned, like N8M or MCP and stuff, you are going to be extremely effective and valuable. That now is the time for... Part of the threat is if you are highly specialized, only know one thing, but not really an expert in that area, maybe a problem. But if you're a little bit more of a generalist, like most of us are, you're going to have a world of opportunity in front of you. And I'm excited by this. And, you know, one of the things when I get to sit down and talk to, you know, the people at OpenAI, you know, like Sam Altman or like Jakob Hotsky, who is the head scientist at OpenAI, mm-hmm. And I ask them a question, the answers I get are not what people often think the answers are. There's this idea that like I've heard people say, well, OpenAI said they're trying to replace all work. I'm like, I don't know that anybody said that ever.
Not at OpenAI. Yeah.
No, they've said, you know, trying to replace most work. And the difference is the idea that there will always be new categories that continue to expand. You know, the plow rate replaced 98% of all economic work. That 2% is where all the jobs came from because we needed more of that. And when we talked to Jakob and Simone, who are really neat guys, if you can check out the interview, I highly recommend it. I asked them how they knew each other, and it turned out they knew each other since high school.
Yeah.
They both went to the same magnets program in Poland because there was a great computer science teacher they wanted to study with. And he was very inspiring to them. And as I talked to Jakob, again, this is the guy who's head the head scientist at OpenAI, who is working on the fusion in the future. He is one of the smartest people in the world, like literally one of the smartest people in the world, who has a very clear idea of where he thinks AI is headed. And I said, well, what does this mean for teaching? Is this, what is it going to mean for that? Is this going to get rid of teachers? And he just laughed. He laughed and said, no, because to him, that teacher, here's the way to think about this was, if you want to look at the future, look at a gifted teacher. If you're a teacher teaching a gifted, what you already know is everybody in there is smarter than you, right?
Yeah.
Your job isn't to be the smartest person in the classroom. Your job is to use life experience. Your job is to inspire. Your job is to show them, hey, I'm a human, you're a human. I show you my journey. Let me help you understand this and to see you for who you are and to have the shared experience of being humans. I think we're going to have robots in the classroom. I'm all for ChatGPT in the classroom. I'm all for this. And at the center of it, wonderful teachers. And that's how they feel. That's how everybody at OpenAI felt, was like, no, it doesn't get rid of that. And when I talk to artists, who, like, I had a conversation that I had a friend who's a big pro into AI, but worried, like, what does this mean when all of a sudden VO can make a whole film or whole movie? I'm like, what does it mean if you're an artist and I can snap a photo and get an image, you know, instead of painting it? Well, painters are going to figure out how to be better than that and do their own thing. And people are going to find new ways to use the camera. And that's how we get motion pictures in cinema. And that Justin gets to vibe code this, if you're a gamer going, well, what's going to happen to game studios? Like, well, small teams are going to be able to create stuff as awesome. You know, gaming, a lot of companies are going to become like rock bands and stuff. It's going to be kind of a thing where you have a really cool vision and idea. The technology is, it's just, it's the different. Think about it this way. Imagine instead of AI, we just use the word money. Because right now, if I said, hey, if I had infinite money, I could make any movie I want. I can make anything I want. I can make any company I want. But only a few people have that kind of money. Well, now everybody gets that in the form of, you know, anybody can call, you know, if you can call a team together to make a movie today, congratulations to Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Now everybody gets to do that. And so now the really talented people are going to be doing really talented stuff.
You know, yeah, I think, you know, at the risk of us doing our you know, timeshare pitch for AI for the millionth time, like I do think that these are augmenting skills, and that a lot of the projections that come, the scary projections that come from where AI is going, at least when it comes to economics and stuff like that, are almost inherently discounting how important a human is and how much we will always prefer a superpowered human than we will to a robot. And if we do prefer a robot to a human, it means that the human's output would be indistinguishable from it. And it's probably tedious to the point where humans don't necessarily want to do it if they don't have to. Like, anything that's enriching or exciting that we can make a connection on, we'll prefer a human in a mech suit than we will just the robot itself. And I think that that always comes with, you know, a little bit of change. But the good news is, for the vast majority of people that are listening to this, we've lived through that change before. We've lived through the idea of the personal computer coming through. We've lived through the idea of email and online shopping replacing physical shopping centers in many different ways. That was a tremendous shift in our economy and in our consumer economy. And yeah, there was some pain, and some stores went away and some businesses popped up. But guess what? There were thousands and thousands more small businesses that emerged from the ability to be able to find, source a material and then ship it based on an online web portal, because there were different shopping habits that were created. This is just the way of the world. And all I will say is this, you know, computers were very, very exciting for folks who liked hardware, for folks who liked, you know, this is early 70s, 80s computing. Very exciting for people who wanted to use that. The internet was very exciting for people who obviously wanted to connect. You built culture on top of it, but also the coding element was extraordinarily rewarding. You saw that supercharged with apps and everything on both of those fronts. This is an entirely new paradigm, and we don't know where it's going to go and where it's going to end up, but we know that the wave is swelling now. So get on in and start paddling. Nothing's too late. You're still incredibly early for all of it.
I will, you know, again, the Andrew Main story, I didn't learn to code till I was like 42 or 43 years old, you know, and then became, you know, a founding member of the applied engineering team at OpenAI because it was a frontier. And what they needed were people with energy to look at this from new eyes and to explore this. Now is a great time to get into this, folks, because guess what? Things that were around a lot of people who got into it kind of 2 years ago still have this two-year-old model too about stuff. And I'm like, things move fast. So if you jump in now, it's a great time. It is a wonderful time. You can be an advantage. And I think that anybody who listens, no matter what field you're in, 6 months from now, you can be the most effective person you know with AI. You can be the most effective person you know with AI. I will tell you something encouraging that I've had happen at least twice that people have done that have showed me friends close to mine. I've, you know, several friends that are very curious people trying to make sense of the world, trying to make sense of politics and a lot of this. And independently, two of them told me they did the same thing with ChatGPT. And that is, you know, I asked it to steel man the opposing argument. I've asked it to criticize my point of view. I've asked it to help me understand how other people feel this way or feel differently than this. And I thought about that of, I have been very lucky to have throughout my life friends who are very good at offering opposing points of view or steel manning stuff that we could have this really healthy dialogue. Justin, obviously, you know, you've been the main one. And not everybody has that. A lot of people have friends that just say the same things they do, think the same things they do, like the same things. We're pretty aligned, but we're also very okay, but what's the other point of view here? What are we missing? You know, what is the other thing there? And I'd say that
we both share a terror of being caught with our ass in the breeze because we've gotten too high on our own supply.
delight in being contrarians. If we walk into a room and everybody is team A, we're going to say, well, here's the team B thing. Here's team B. Yeah. We walk into a room full of team B. Well, here's the team A thing. Here's the team A thing. Probably enjoy the contrarian thing, maybe a little bit too much, but so much so that that's been great. But it's been healthy though, because then it's like, it's a very much thing is very few things surprise us. Very few things cause us guard and very few things make us emotional, you know? But having seen friends embrace this tool in a way, an intellectually honest way, by their own way of saying this, like my wife has done this. My wife, you know, Roshni's done this where she's said, yeah, you know, somebody said this, I'm like, disagreed with it, but I asked ChatGPT, I'm like, can you explain to me their point of view? Yeah. Now I want you to hear mine. Tell me where I'm wrong, or tell me where I'm this, or tell me where I'm that. And we know there's the talk about the psychopathy of these models, but that's also something a lot of people want. They just want to be confirmed. You can also use these models to challenge you. Mm-hmm. And I think what an amazing point that you can in the privacy of your own home, sit down with the system and have a conversation, not in front of another person, try out your opinions, understand it, challenge yourself, no embarrassment, no nothing for it to tell you like, well, that article you cited didn't exist or this or whatever. It's incredible.
It's the societal impact of no shame progress. I don't think people have really reconciled with. The idea, you know, when year and a half ago, I guess, maybe 2 years ago now, geez, time flies. But I was working on a blog post for OpenAI. I was just doing research, talking to teachers around the world about how they were using ChatGPT. And regardless of what level, regardless of where geographically, from Africa to New England to LA to old England, they all had the same versions of the same story. Students can break down concepts without fear or shame of being embarrassed in front of their peers or being diminished in the eyes of the teacher. And those are two, you know, we didn't even think of them, I think, as blockers. Probably educators did. Then they would, you know, good educators would figure out ways to kind of hack those impediments. But now it's entirely in the hands of the student. And like, you know, you could do that on the internet to a certain extent, but you can't go to a website and then just keep asking it. If you don't totally get it immediately, you can't just keep asking it questions. Yeah, but what about? Yeah, but what about? Yeah, but what about?
Yeah.
Now you can't. And then, you know, to your point about stating an opinion, the way I look at ChatGPT or any of these large language models for stuff like that is like, I just think of it as like a guy on the street. What if there was a guy on the street that you could always stop and you could just say, hey, settle a bet here. I say this, this guy says this, what do you think? And you're just going to get an immediate forthright answer. And like, maybe it's exactly correct. Maybe it's something that you need to do further research on. But if you need an icebreaker, you need somebody to just, you know, kind of flip a coin and make a point, then it's there. And then beyond that, I think this is where the real skill of the technology comes in, is in how good it is in like, oh, crap, that is really interesting. Wow, I guess that point is a little bit weak. Maybe if I, and this is really the biggest thing that I've noticed, at least in my own life, is it's not necessarily what my arguments are or what I want to say, it's how I say it. Is it getting mm-hmm. through? Is the signal that I want being transmitted in a hearable way? Or is there something in how I'm saying it or my tone of voice or the order in which I am saying things that's getting it jumbled up? And so people don't hear it in the same way. It's you know, it's powerful. It's really, really good tech.
Yeah, I have a friend that's using it to like help me articulate what I'm thinking, help me articulate this, and basically giving it more structure or like giving him analogies. And he's found it to be an incredibly powerful tool. And I've watched him become a more open-minded person.
Yeah.
You know, I've watched him say, and the signs of this where I thought this, then I started to realize I was going down that path. Now I think about this, or I look at it this way or whatever. Like I actually did the research, you know, I was listening to this person say this, and then I understood the weakness of that argument, whatever. And I would say that he's a person that's much more likely to change his mind based upon evidence, you know, and in things that are contradictory or whatever. And it came from him getting into the safe space of being able to talk to ChatGPT all the time, challenging himself, not afraid, because nobody's going to go, I gotcha, or hit him with a zinger, you know, like, ah, here's a meme of you, you're stupid, whatever, and go back and forth on that. And then also get the kind of the reward of going, oh, I get this, I understand that. And that was a very promising thing for me to see was, people who are using these tools in good faith and trying to use them in intellectually honest ways. And there's ways you can use it. Just reinforce me. Tell me I'm right. Tell me I'm this, you know, go out of your way to get it to cave to you and make you happy. But at the end of the day, you're just throwing, you know, you're asking a bunch of numbers to validate you.
Yeah. All right. You got any picks?
I have picks. I have two picks. One was we saw The Naked Gun in movie theaters. Enjoyed it. Have you seen it yet?
No. We had the option to watch either that or Friendship last Saturday, and we wound up going with Friendship. But yeah, I'm excited. I've heard nothing but positive things about, especially from people that really liked and appreciated the original Naked Gun, that it understood the assignment.
Very much so. Yeah, that was my note, was like they understood the assignment. They got it right. They did a good thing. A pretty good level of beat of last per minute. Does its own sort of stuff. You know, it's a movie made for 2025. I enjoyed it. Really liked it. Liam Neeson's great. Just a great, in the great tradition of Leslie Nielsen. Let's take a really great serious actor.
Yeah.
Have them do comedy, because the really good comedy is people don't know they're in a comedy. And yes. Danny Houston, who plays the bad guy, is great, because Danny Houston plays him like a bad guy that Danny Houston would play in another movie. It's more absurd. They're not trying to do, like, I think there's comedians who play very broad and do big and do whatever. You got your Mike Myers, and it's like, it's kind of like why Alec Baldwin is always great in comedy, because Alec Baldwin's like, I'm going to be the same guy you saw in movies in the 90s. But in an absurd situation. Like, what was the mimic? I still remember that, the SNL sketch. Remember he played the mimic? It was the one where they hire this guy because the kidnapping thing, and he gets on it like he's the mimic. He's all smooth Alec. Yeah. Alec Baldwin, like, oh, yeah, I can handle a situation. The kidnapper's on the phone. The woman's going to pick up the phone. Says, no, I got this.
Yeah. Yes,
this is Mrs. Johnson. He's just terrible at it,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But it was just, I love that kind of, I love that humor where you get a great actor who's really good at that. So enjoyed that. Thought it was really good. Pamela Anderson was great. Really good. Really fun. And then my other pick, Alien Earth.
It's good, huh?
It's good, solid, good. You know, trying to bring that to TV is hard. I think they Noah Hawley did a really good job. I'm involved in the characters, and it's one of these things where you're first, you're like, ah, it's aliens on Earth. He's also like, yes. By the way, I don't know if you know this, but there is currently a culture war, so to speak, because we have humans augmented with technology that are cyborgs.
Yeah.
We have the synths, which is synthetic humans, which you saw in Aliens.
Yeah.
And also we have the hybrids, which are robots with human consciousness transferred into them. And I'm like, tell me more. I'm used Let's to go. One of those ideas, the idea that I'm going to bring to you three really interesting science fiction ideas. And we had an episode last night where cyborgs and synths do not get along. It was, there's a great scene where the cyborg and a synth are in there, and you know, words are spoken, insults are traded, and you're like, oh, this is what we're gonna look forward to, folks.
That's awesome. I am excited to dig into that, because Noah Hawley doesn't miss, as it turns out. That dude just clicks. I mean, like, putting together just a TV resume for all time. Like, if you just look at the tonnage of like good television that Noah Hawley has put his name on, like, I don't know. He probably now you stack up his resume and you're like, damn, like he's probably put together more good episodes than people that we would consider absolutely legendary. I mean, not since the broadcast television era. You know, if you look at somebody like Stephen Bochco or somebody like that, like that dude just once every 2 years puts out a banger, and it doesn't matter what it is. It's like, sometimes it's Legion, sometimes it's Fargo, sometimes it's Alien Earth. That guy he just does it. He just does the damn thing.
Yeah, I was watching a documentary, a little YouTube documentary about like the TV show Wise Guy, which I think was Stephen J. Cannell and Frank Lupo. I think they worked on it. I'm trying to remember, but what's interesting was that they had to sell the network on the idea of let us do a show that's not just episodic, that's a long, like a season long North Star. And that was season two was where Kevin Spacey became famous, because he was the villain of the big villain of that season. And the idea that you realize, oh, these writers were great back then.
Yeah.
They just had to deal with TV that said, no, it has to be, we need a guy with a talking car, has to close every week.
Exactly.
We need a girl in a bikini, need this. And they're like, what if we did long form? No, you do not get it too long form. It won't work. Now we're getting great storytellers getting to tell the stories the way they want to tell them. And it's amazing.
That's awesome. My pick is Friendship. Go check it out. It is Paul Rudd and Tim Robinson. If you enjoy I Think You Should Leave, this will be very familiar. It has a lot of the same beats, sometimes even the same tropes as I Think You Should Leave. It's played more serious than I Think You Should Leave, but not entirely serious. I will warn anybody that you might be confused that if you see Paul Rudd and Tim Robinson, you might think, wow, this could be a $200 million studio comedy where things happen on the block and they're friends and then they're not friends and then they're friends. It is not that movie. One day, Tim Robinson probably will be in a studio comedy that makes a gigantic amount of money because he's very popular and he's an incredibly talented comedian. This is an A24 movie. It is an A24 movie. This is more about subtle notes than it is about broad strokes. Although this is, it's got its laughs, but I was excited to watch it, and I'm recommending it to you right now, friends.
Awesome. Justin?
Yeah.
Spirit of Brian?
Yes.
It's been weird.